Welcome to the show. I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Thank you for listening, downloading, going to the website and listening, however you're doing this. I am a little bit under the weather. I'm having bad allergies or something's going on with my sinuses. I woke up at like 3 in the morning and blew my nose for like an hour straight. And now I'm like this. And actually, tomorrow, I start a run of 6 shows in the next 8 days. So I'm going to rest my voice after I do this, and you know, rest, get ready. I just got back from rehearsal with Liars and Saints, sounding good. My old band, we're getting together. We're playing a show next Wednesday at Antone's. Wednesday, March 6th. If you're in Austin, come on down to Antone's at 9 p.m. We'll be playing. That's in the year 2013, in case you're listening to this very far in the future. Or, you know what, maybe it's gone all the way around and you're listening to this in the past. Whoa. I just blew my own mind, guys. I just blew my own mind. So, T, emergency, echinacea, and maybe some antibiotics. I think I might have to do that. I've got some here, actually. It's an emergency supply I keep hidden. That's how you do it in rock and roll. Emergency antibiotics. All right. My guest today is an amazing musician, bass player, great producer, George Reef. You might know him from such acts as Ray Wiley Hubbard, Jacob Dylan, Chris Robinson. He was in the Charlie Sexton Sextet. He's in the Courtyard Hounds. He's an amazing musician. He does tons of stuff. He produces bands, a band of heathens. I've known him for over 20 years. First saw him with his band Big Loud Dog back in the late 80s, early 90s. Can't really remember exactly. But in Houston. Anyway, we got to know each other. We've been in Ian Moore's band together, and we've done a ton of shows where he was in one band and I was in another one, and we've always been good friends. He's a great hang. A lot of people have been asking about having him on the show. So I guess without making you wait anymore, here's my very good friend, George Reef.
That's all right. There's no dub echo on there. I kind of thought it would.
I was going to use that. Have you ever been to Jamaica?
No.
Oh, they run. I think they, like, when you go to parties. I went to like a beach party there with my guide. Like, you know, you go there, you got to kind of find. Jan Merkin told me you got to find a guy that you can trust. That'll keep you from getting killed and stuff.
Right.
And you know, drug deals gone bad. And he took me to a thing, and it's like the huge echo and the delays. Fuck him! Be gone! And the dude just yells over every song.
That's what I want to
get. That's
what
the DJ does. So you said you might not be here at South by Southwest?
I might not, although my pal Robert Harrison, who you also know, I believe, said that there might be a Cotton Mather show and he wants me to play. So I could stay for that, but I may go off and it might be the 1 week that I have to leave town, and I might have to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
Because I haven't had a break in a while.
Well, we were talking earlier, and I know that there's a myth and a rumor. There's a mythical South by Southwest where you played 22 shows.
That's not mythical.
No, not mythical, but not mythical, legendary.
Legendary,
that's what I mean. Yeah, sorry. That's not mythical. Like, I played those 22 shows.
I did.
It's like, I thought you were going to go Buzz Aldrin on me. You know, when the guy comes up and tells him he didn't really land on the moon, he just punches him in the face.
It was more than just a mythic and illusory South by Southwest. It was a true South by Southwest.
How many people were you playing with? How many?
I want to say it was like 8 or 9 bands, something like that. And what would happen is what would happen oftentimes in years past, where I would say yes to 2 or 3 things that I was doing, people I was at that time currently performing with. And then if they said it's only going to be 2 shows, as you well know,
right,
something happens and then it's 4 shows. And then I'd said yes to a couple of other people for 1 show, and then that became another show. And there was 22 shows.
Wow.
It was crazy.
It's weird because none of them were at the exact same time. Did you hire someone to drive you?
I was post motorcycle. Because I had
you're like Prince.
I did. I had a couple of years where I would like put my bass on my back and just like park my bike in the alley and run in, play.
Well, that's that's the only way to go.
Yeah, it worked great.
So who was the other guy that had, you were saying somebody else might have challenged
this Austin drummer, Darren Hess.
Okay.
I think he either challenged it or surpassed it. And there could well be more people at this point, you know.
JJ must have had some kind of competition. JJ Johnson, the great drummer.
JJ's had a lot. In fact, 1 year when we were both playing with Ian Moore, we had to walk through like 12 blocks of pouring thunderous rain in suits with I had 2 guitars and he had cymbals and some snare drums, and we're like walking to get to Ian's show that's in a tent outside. And it was so hot in the tent and it was so cold outside. We got inside and there's a video of us playing in our soaked suits, but we're steaming.
Oh,
because
weird.
It's so hot, yeah, and there's just steam coming up from both of us. It's great.
So let's figure this out. I don't know exactly how to start, but I'll start with where I met you was some 23 or 24 years ago.
That was quite some time ago, Johnny.
Yes, that was some time ago.
Speaking of my good ear.
I was at the Fitzgeralds in Houston.
The Fitzgeralds.
I was just hanging out.
In your overalls.
And I came across a great band that was playing the kind of music I wanted to hear. And it was Big Loud Dog.
That was a good band.
It was a power pop trio.
Right.
And then the very next day, the bass player from that band was walking through Whole Foods where I worked in Houston. And I freaked out, and it turned out you were going out with my friend that ran the cheese, beer, wine, and cheese department.
That's right. Who then shortly after became my wife.
Yeah. So I freaked out. And then ever since then, I just kind of saw you around. Were you living? You were living in Dallas then, because you guys were a Dallas band.
I have to remember the timeline. It is a little blurry. I think we had moved back to Houston, or no, we had not yet moved to Dallas. That's what it was.
Okay,
we were in Houston, and the rest of the band were in Dallas, and that's what ended up taking us to Dallas for a few years.
Okay, how long was that band?
That band was probably a 3-year project, yeah, something like that. We were the band for at that time, kind of a rhythm and blues jump swing guy from Fort Worth named Johnny Reno.
Oh, yeah.
And we were his band, and we just decided we needed to stop wearing the suits for a while.
Yeah.
And do our own thing.
Yeah.
And we played, we had a really memorable South by Southwest the last year we were together, where they used to have these panels where they would judge your band. You would bring a cassette, of course, pre-CD.
Right.
So you'd bring a cassette, and there'd be some panel of celebrity judges. And on our panel, there was this one guy named Kim Fowley.
Oh, yeah.
He's like the old-time, from the old-time school of the Idol Maker.
He's the guy, if those of you that are listening, what's the Runaways movie?
The Runaways, yeah.
He's the guy. He's Svengali.
Yeah, and he had other bands like that.
Pussy to the Wood! And they're playing guitar.
So, like, he was drawn out of the celebrity panel to judge our tape, and he pressed play, and we were so proud of our 3-song demo, and song 1 came on, he gave it about 15 seconds. Song 2 came on, he probably gave it about 30. Song 3 came on, he listened a little more, and then he stopped, and he popped the tape out and held it in his hand. He said, All I can tell you about this band is they'll play anytime, anywhere for a case of beer, and then threw the tape over his shoulder and he went, next. That was it. That was his soul.
What was your reaction to that?
We were kind of shocked, but we figured, you know, bad press is better than no press.
That's true. He was the only, no one else said anything? Or was he was the most memorable?
Well, see, every band would get one celebrity judge.
Oh, okay.
There were, you
okay.
know, there'd be like six of them
right.
up there.
Right. They wouldn't argue like American Idol stuff.
No, that okay. would have been better, though.
You pitchy dog.
Yeah, that's right. Get out of the business.
So where are you from?
I'm from the East Coast.
You are?
Yeah. New York and D.C.
Okay.
But I've lived in Texas longer at this point. So I claim to be a Texan.
Where you were born in New York or D.C.? Mm-hmm.
I was born in New York.
Okay.
New York City.
How big is your family?
My family is very small at this point because I came from a family of much, you know, it was an older, very older generation family.
Okay.
And so now it's my mother and my brother and his family and myself. And then we have some kind of extended family out on the West Coast.
Oh, nice.
So it's small, but everyone's in Austin, so...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I get to hang with them, which is good.
That's very good. How did you get introduced to music? What was that about?
I got introduced to music because my father was a jazz drummer.
Oh, okay.
That he did not take it seriously. He did it to put himself through college. But his drums were around, and he would say, make your old man happy and learn how to play something. And so...
That's nice.
I tried to pick up a little trumpet, a little guitar, but... I just became enamored of the bass and stuck with that.
How old were you when you made that decision?
I think I was 12 when I made the bass decision.
What was it? Was there a guy?
Oh, yeah. I based it on, accidental pun. I did base my decision on the fact that being a young Beatles fan,
right.
Paul McCartney had the coolest looking guitar and I didn't know what it was and I wanted one that looked like that. So I asked my mom for one of those for my birthday. And it just coincidentally turned out to be a bass.
Wow.
So that was it. Shallow, but effective.
No, it all starts somehow.
Right.
And so so when did you start a band? When did you first get in a band or start a band? What did you do, get in one or start one?
You know, I think I got in one probably in high school. Yeah. You know, doing some parties, this and that, trying to be in the, you know, the talent show at
yeah.
school. But it became memorable probably around college time because I kept trying to go to school. And then I would get propositioned by a band to go on the road, and then I would leave, and then it would be too late to come back, and then another semester would go by. And this went on for about a year and a half, and then I said, I just need to keep playing music.
Yeah. What were you going to do? Were you going to do something else, and you were just kind of like playing music to get yourself through college like your dad or something?
No, I wasn't quite sure yet. You know, it was probably a photography career I was pursuing. Yeah.
You're an all-around artist, a culinary artist.
That's it, culinary artist, everything.
A visual artist, a musical artist.
That's right.
Yeah. That's a... So where did you go to school?
I went to school, I mean, high school and everything.
No, I'm at college.
Oh, at U of H.
U of H. Yeah. Okay. Was your family living there?
Yeah, we were in Houston.
Okay.
We came to Texas, you know, from... the East Coast, from D.C. And then I was in Houston for years, as you were.
Yeah.
And I you know, Houston still kind of gets a bad rap in Texas, which I can see for some reasons, but I enjoy it.
I still like
going back there. I still have good feelings about the city.
Me too. I wasn't like a guy that moved here that made fun, like, thank God I'm not in Houston.
I know people, that's
a lot
what
of people
you got.
Do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you go
Darren
to Dallas.
Went through that for a few years. Darren was like the least Houston person I'd ever met for a while.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
But, yeah.
Because he is Houston.
Yeah, we
him
all
and
are.
His sister. Yeah.
We are Houston.
We are Houston. We claim it. We reclaim it.
The faces of Houston. So where were you, in Houston, when you were going out on the road with bands, who were the bands? Would I know them? Or were they?
I don't know. They would be like, it would be a mix of these obscure jobbing party bands, country bands. And then my band, my kind of up and coming new wave band.
Oh, cool. What was it?
Called the Haskells.
Okay.
Suitably new wave name at the time.
Yeah, that is a good new wave name.
Yeah, it was good. There's some really compromising photos.
Who was the really good new wave band from Houston? And they had like a record out, I remember, and it was the 80s because...
The most popular one I can think of was probably... The Judies.
They
were huge.
Yeah, yeah.
They'd sell out big theaters.
Yeah.
And they would bring things like washing machines and vacuums on stage and squeak. You know, it was the modern age. Everything was the ironic tip of the hat to the modern age.
So you had skinny ties?
I had skinny ties. That was, look, man, I had skinny ties, and I pushed up the sleeves on my jacket, and I never owned a keyboard tie, luckily.
I'm gonna blow your mind in a minute. I got a picture with one. I did. I had a keyboard tie.
But those were our ironic mustaches.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true. Because I didn't even play keyboards then.
Right, you didn't need to. It was just cool.
So when did you get the first like big kind of significant band you were in was the Johnny Reno and the Sax Maniacs, right?
No, I think it was probably Joe King Carrasco.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know that you played with him.
Oh, man, I played with him for 5-6 years. I started when I was 22. I moved to London for a while.
I didn't know.
To be in this, at that time, very popular new wave band called the Jags. Okay. The Jags were a true one-hit wonder in Europe, and they had a single called I Got Your Number written on the back of my hand. Huge. Great. Power pop classic. It's on Rhino compilations and whatnot. And the guitar player in my band in Houston, who was English, had started with that band.
Right.
And so he got me to go over there and join the band. But when I showed up, the band was, you know, it was in dissolution, and the lead singer was, he'd been kind of whipped by the press, kicked. And he was
in that
down
English
and out.
Way.
In that English
they
way,
just,
that,
like Americans think that you get it bad here.
Oh, they
make it. So I'm surprised more people don't just kill themselves there because they just ruin you.
Oh, they ruin you. They destroy you. And yeah. he was a broken man living in what they call a council flat in Clapham, and Clapham is now a really posh south of the river suburb in London. But at the time, it was south of the river, which was decidedly seedy.
Right.
So. And I was there for a while, and, you know, I had some, went on a lot of auditions and worked in a pub and lived. Yeah, I had a good time while I was there.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time.
Yeah, it was a good time.
You were early 20s?
I was maybe 21.
Wow, yeah.
So it was a great time to be there.
New country,
new wave.
New wave. And then you went from new wave to Nuevo Huevo.
Nuevo Huevo, yeah. Played with Joe.
So were you like on Saturday Night Live and stuff with him?
Just after Saturday Night Live. In fact, he was looking for a bass player, and then I left because I was already committed to go to London. And then he got another bass player who was with them for about 6 months, and that's when they did Saturday Night Live.
And that's... At that point, there was like a video on MTV Party Weekend, right? That was a big...
Huge. Joe had some moments where he was big. I mean, the largest crowd I've ever played to in my life was with Joe.
Yeah? What was that?
That was at a festival in Paris, a festival against racism in the Place de Concorde. And we played at dawn, and it was 120,000 people, maybe.
Wow.
It was huge.
Wow. That was intense, man.
It was really intense. I remember that show really well. I remember playing to that crowd and the sun's coming up. It was very like Hendrix at Woodstock moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember getting two people from the Talking Heads in because they were locked out of the grounds and no one knew who they were.
Wow.
So it was an interesting little day.
Yeah, that is awesome.
Joe was big in France.
I bet when he's such a physical guy, you know? Like, the whole thing is so physical.
Yeah, it was a show. It was
like,
a non-stop
it precedes
show.
Eddie Vedder. You know what I mean? Like, the Eddie completely. Vedder climbing all over everything. Like, that dude was still doing it even, like, 15 years ago.
I saw one of their reunion shows, one of Joe's reunion shows a couple years ago. He doesn't jump off the top of the PA anymore, but he did put his guitar down and jump out into the crowd, and they passed him around.
Yeah, he's a fucking amazing entertainer and a really sweet guy.
Super sweet guy.
Very funny. Sweet. Yeah. Very funny. Very, very nice.
Yeah.
I remember one time I showed up to a gig at Cafe on the Square, and we had been double booked. And the guy was like, sorry, you know, he's already set up and ready to go, and you're not going to do it. You're not going to get money. And he, like, we were leaving, and he was like, what happened? And I told him, I didn't really know him, but we knew each other were. And I said, this, you know, you got the gig and it's double booked, and so we're leaving. And he was like, no, no, no. And he went back and told the guy we were playing and paid us, I think himself.
Wow, that's a very Joe thing.
It was just very, he was just like, no, 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 you're not going. This is your gig, you know? You got to do this.
He is, you know, I see him very little these days, but he was always a very soulful guy. He would go to Mexico several times
every
year.
He's there now, right?
That's Yeah, he lives there now. He lives there and he raises show dogs, apparently.
That's awesome.
Walks around the streets of Mazatlan and wears a cape.
That is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
So so you did that for how long? 5 years?
Yeah, probably 5 years.
Wow.
4 or 5 years.
And toured the world?
Toured the world.
The whole time?
Yeah. We did really well in Europe.
What did you end up, how did you end up stepping out of that?
I stepped out of that to join a band in Austin with some friends of mine that was short-lived, and you know, I had a good time because they were my friends.
It was this band
called Zulu Time.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It was an interesting band. That was
a band that had a lot of promise.
It had a lot of promise.
People were still talking about that band in the 90s.
I know, it was interesting. It had a lot of promise because my partner and I wrote all the songs, and we were budding songwriters, and we had a good time. Somehow, the band turned into this weird industry chasing, trendy clothes wearing, not so hip thing, and I think that's why I left.
Who all was in the band?
There was a guitar player and songwriter that used to live here in town named Dave Davis, who was in the band. There's a guy two musicians who still are involved in music, a guitar player named Cole Hansen.
Yeah, that's right. Cole was in the band.
And a drummer who, he's had a few different name changes, but at the
Kevin. Yeah,
Kevin.
That's why I played with Kevin.
Right. Okay. And then the singer was a guy named Mike Moyer, who is also still singing.
One of my favorite singers.
Great singer.
One of my favorite, great dude.
Great dude, yeah.
Yeah.
So I loved hanging out with those guys, and I love making music. It's just, I think it was just, they kind of wanted to go in a different direction than
I did. That's a great band.
Yeah, it was a really great band.
That was amazing. And what was the style of music?
It was, you know, it was, what, when was it? It was like the, you know, mid-80s, I suppose. So it was influenced by, you know, lots of new wave stuff. But we tried to, like, have as little of that infiltrate the rock.
That's a great way to describe that music.
You know. But we all love Cheap Trick, and
yeah.
And we like loud guitars, and we would, I think we definitely had promised to be something great. And those guys went on and did really well for themselves.
Yeah, everyone. I see Mike Moyer every once in a while, just like out of the blue.
He's an amazing country singer.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing now.
That's what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He went on to be a bass guy too. He played bass with Trish Murphy.
He did. And he's a great bass player.
Great bass player. So then you got in Johnny Reno and Sax Maniacs?
Yeah, I think I started. No, what did I do before that? I played with this guy named Mason Ruffner.
Right.
I have to think about this timeline. And Mason was at the peak of his game.
He 87.
Was 87, yeah. He was a Fort Worth guitar player that moved to New Orleans and garnered a bunch of acclaim for his particular brand of singing and playing. And he took a lot of guitar showmanship from the Fort Worth blues guys. Which, there's this whole school of blues guitar in Texas where it's really showy. And he would, you know, all the stuff that people knew through Jimi Hendrix, like playing with your teeth, playing behind your back.
Yeah.
That was all, you know, kind of old.
Fort Worth stuff?
Yeah, Fort Worth stuff. There's a guy in Fort Worth for a long time that I used to go see named U.P. Wilson. He would play two guitars upright on stools and just hold the necks.
Wow.
And he would just play with his hands sliding up and down the necks. You know, you'd go to these blues clubs and you'd see these guys like play guitars and then pick up a metal table with their teeth or eat light bulbs or whatever insane vaudeville blues trip they could get on.
That's
they would
awesome.
Do it. Yeah, it was great. So Mason was from that school and we had some real success playing good shows, opening on really big tours.
Who all did you guys tour with then?
We toured with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and we toured with U2. We were on the Joshua Tree tour for about a month, and that was pretty exciting.
Wow.
Lots of other people.
That, How was that Joshua Tree tour?
It was great. I mean, did you
get on the big side of it? Because wasn't that was the split tour where they started off in like arenas and then stadiums in the middle of the tour?
We were in the arenas, okay. But they were still the biggest band in the world at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were under a lot of pressure. But I have to say that even thinking back how long ago that was now, I still remember those shows really clearly, and I remember how amazing they were and how they owned the stage every night, which is something that I always think people can and do need to think about when they get on stage, that it's your stage, you know, and you need to control it and you need to let people in the audience know that. And there's nothing embarrassing about it. I mean, the trend in music and indie rock bands is to be very self-conscious, I think. And yeah. I don't want to stereotype anyone. I'm noting.
No, yeah.
To be awkward and to be self-conscious and to deliberately downplay stage antics or the fact that you own or control the stage. Right. And you just kind of want to be one of the audience.
Yeah.
So it's a much more humble thing. Everything's an inside joke.
Yeah.
But it's just a different way of performing.
I had a big in the, like, when Mr. Rocket Baby started, I was bumming out because everyone was in shorts.
Right.
And you really couldn't tell the dude in the band from the dude in the audience. And I remember being like, I don't want that. I want there to definitely, like, I'm not paying to go see this dude in shorts.
No.
You know what I mean?
I'm wearing shorts.
If someone's
going to
pay, even
better.
If it's $5, I'm going to wear a fucking top hat and flowered tights.
That's it. And you did.
Yeah.
And you look good.
Thanks, man.
No, Mr. Rocket Baby, that was one of the things I remember about that band, is you controlled the stage. You weren't afraid to put on a show. It was never cheesy. It was just soulful.
Thanks.
And great.
I mean, it was a little tongue-in-cheek, but there was, you know, it was almost like if Skyrocket was an original band or something. You know what I mean? We were kind of like almost like a show. Anyway, so the Mason Ruffner thing, when that ended, then you started with Johnny Reno?
Then I started with Johnny Reno.
And then you did Big Loud Dog.
Did Big Loud Dog. That was my band.
And then you moved to Austin?
Then I moved to Austin and then started playing with everyone in Austin through the 90s. I can't even list everyone. I was always playing.
I can tell you some of my favorite ones.
Okay.
I really loved the Sextet.
The Sextet was fantastic.
That was a special band, I thought.
It was a special band.
And you guys made a really special record. You were on that record, right?
Yeah.
The Wishing Tree? That was a... Saw you on TV.
Yeah, that was good. That was a good time. That was a special band because it was spearheaded by a special person who was Charlie Sexton.
Yeah.
And then occasionally another very special person, his brother Will Sexton.
Yeah.
And those are astoundingly talented and riveting musicians. And the thing about Charlie is he assembled this great band, but if he had to, he could play every instrument in the band and usually play it better than you could. No matter what, because he was always bring his own thing to it.
Yeah, he really is. He's a magical person. So, and also that was a group of friends.
Yeah,
I mean, you guys. It was Ramos and
Ramos
Rafael
and Raphael,
and you.
The Satin Latins.
Yeah, the Satin Latins.
It was the hat band. It was the time. It was definitely a hat band. I had to stop wearing hats because it was too many people in hats on stage.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Who else did you play with then? During that time,
you know, I played with songwriters in Austin. Lots and lots of songwriters.
Fricasso, you played a lot with him.
Played with Fricasso.
I saw some of that.
Beaver Nelson.
Beaver Nelson. That was a big one that you played with a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
You spent a lot of, and you played with Cotton Mather.
Cotton Mather made a really kind of important pop record with him called Contiki. Went to Japan. Had a great tour.
So you were part of. Yeah, I mean. You've really done some really amazing things. I remember one time, I know this is later in maybe the 2000s, I was in Nashville playing at something and you just walked out of a bus. You were playing with Chris Robinson.
Chris Robinson.
And I was playing with Endochine at the time.
That's right, I remember that.
Yeah. And then, okay, and you played with Ian Moore during the 90s?
Played with Ian Moore, as both of us did briefly.
Yeah, both of us did together.
Ian's many incarnations of his band, his many flavored bands, and one of them you and I played together.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
I was very excited to get to play with you. And also, we played shows together in the 2000s when I was in Gowdy.
That's right.
And you were playing with Ian.
With Ian. And those were great shows.
Yeah.
Gowdy,
JJ,
the band.
And...
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember a mashup, both bands on stage. in Lubbock. Remember that?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. That big barn of a club.
Yeah.
You guys had more pedal boards than every other band in town.
Well, Ian also was part of that movement.
Ian was copying you.
No. No, I think everyone was trying to have like the, what was the, like the Enterprise in front of their feet. I remember at one point, remember Martin Hanlon, who managed Gaudi?
Oh, yeah.
Scottish dude. He was always like, let's get you to stop fucking dancing when you're up there. As he said, all we do is we look like a bunch of little Irish guys doing a jig the whole show. As we're stepping on all these pedals. At one point, there was 34 pedals.
That's a lot of pedals.
And Einar, the bass player, might have actually had the most pedals.
He might have had the most pedals, yeah. That was a lot of pedals.
So you like the Chris Robinson gig, how did you end up getting that?
I got that through Charlie Sexton.
Okay.
My pal who has looked out for me. He's honestly, in the last 15 years, I have to say that he's been such a pivotal figure in my career because he's helped me so much. And I don't see him as much lately because we're both on different schedules, but he's just pointed me in some directions and given me some referrals and recommended me for things that have been so helpful.
He's that kind of guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He is.
I'm having the hardest time trying to ask him to do this. Isn't that weird?
You should ask him because
I know he would probably say yes.
I guarantee you he'd say yes, and it's the kind of thing that most people probably don't ask him to do.
I know.
And he's funny and he's got good stories.
He's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want him to be like, oh, maybe I'm not interested in doing this kind of thing. And then every time he sees me afterwards, he's like, oh, fuck, here he comes.
Right.
You know?
God.
Yeah, no, I don't want to be that guy. That's the only reason. Anyway.
I'm really curious because I got to ask you, and you don't have to mention any names, yeah. But have you had any bomb interviews where you do it, but you still put it out there and people hear it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's two I didn't put out.
Oh, they were
one of them
bad.
Was the very first one I did with Jeremy Nail, and I just didn't know how to talk. It was real weird. All I had to do it was once and fail completely. Like, I just was like, I was terrible.
Right. Well, I like that you're controlling this interview because, number one, you're sitting up higher.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got my mic really low, and I have to lean in. I noticed the EQ on my voice is a lot thinner, and yours is big and booming like the voice of God, and I'm more like kind of off in the distance.
Exact same. Maybe you can help me.
I don't know. It sounds pretty good. But I'm thinking that this is a good thing that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it makes you look
good. I do like it. The other one that I never put out was a guy who was going through probably the hardest time in his life.
Oh.
Who like was crying when he walked up to the thing.
Oh.
And he was like, he, I guess his girl had funded his jams and she was tired of it.
Oh no.
So she pulled the plug.
Oh no.
And his band quit while he was out on tour, came back to Houston. She's like, get out. He packs up all of his stuff and has to go move back in with his parents. But he stopped off here to do an interview first.
Oh.
And so in courtesy to him, I decided not to put it out because I thought this is not some way that someone wants to be remembered.
No, no, no.
this vibe is not something you want out there.
No, you can give him another shot down the road.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. And you know what? I left him a message. I never heard from him again.
Wow.
I left him a message saying, I don't think you want this out. I like you, and I don't think you want this out. So
that's kind of on your part.
Thanks.
That's not English journalism right there.
No. There was part of me that was going to be like, this is what happens when everything goes fucking wrong. Listen to this guy. But I didn't. I couldn't bring myself to do it. Anyway, so Charlie pointed you in the way of Chris Robinson. And then,
yes.
Okay, so that was early 2000s, right?
That was early 2000s. 2004? Yeah, something like that. And Chris, and through Chris, that pointed me in the direction of Gary Lewis and Mark Olson, and made a record with them and played some shows right before they reformed the Jayhawks.
How did you like that?
I loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah, those guys are so inspiring. That was a really memorable record because we recorded the whole record with no headphones in a room with Gary and Mark about 2 feet from each other, facing each other, playing acoustic guitars and singing live.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'd never done anything like that before, and I realized it was so freeing, and it influenced the way that I like to make records.
Yeah. Is that... So were you already producing?
I was just dabbling.
Kind of dabbling?
I didn't really have it together.
It takes sort of like a... It's like you go from being like a member of the cast to being like the director.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it does take some psychological building up, you know.
It takes time. I mean, some people walk into it and they're fully formed creatures right away. But for me, it took some time. I had to figure it out. And I also wanted to get the technical side together.
Right.
Because I wanted the sound to be as important as everything else. So I needed to learn that also.
Right. And you got to, you also have like the disposition, like the cool hand that makes it a little, you know.
Yeah, I'm patient.
Yeah, patient and calm. I've never seen you freak out.
I freaked out occasionally. And the Iron Fist will come down on people's head from time to time. But it's rare.
So you started out producing records. One of the first ones you did was that Sheboygan record?
Yeah. Is that
right? Yeah.
That was done in the bedroom of my tiny house. As most people start making records these days, it's always in a bedroom.
Well, I've been to the Develop studio, last year? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's even more developed. There's a tape machine and a big console in there.
Oh, wow.
Now. Yeah. It's always growing.
Always growing. It's always growing, isn't it?
It's always growing.
You never have everything.
No, and that's the scary thing.
It's very disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, my bank account resides in my control room, basically. That's right. You came last year and you played some amazing puffy-sleeved Shostakovich piano on this woman Brittany Shane's album, and you played great. No one else would have done the same thing.
Thank you.
It's perfect.
Yeah, thanks for asking me to do it, too. Yeah. You and Scrappy were working on that.
That's right.
So, you also played with Mac?
I played with Mac for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. How was that for you?
That was fantastic. That was an education in rock and roll.
You know, and you have that same thing that he does. When I did this interview with him, I was astonished at seeing him one week on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame getting inducted and playing, you know, with all the guys there and doing his thing with Ron Wood. And then the next Thursday, he's playing for free at the Lucky Lounge.
Yeah, he doesn't
nowhere
care.
Near the audience. But he's giving the same performance, and you're that same kind of guy. You're as excited to play with somebody like Chris Robinson as you are with, you know, a guy.
I play with our pal Scrappy Jed every Monday at the Strange Brew, which is in South Austin.
Oh, really?
And I'm just as excited to do that as I am to go and play anywhere else.
You're a real musician. Charlie's like that.
Yeah.
You know.
If you're going to play, you're going to play.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that is what it's all about. So you started, you did the Sheboygan record. They did the theme song of I took one of their songs, one of their newer ones, for the theme song for the show.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize that.
And did you do a Ray Wiley? You played with Ray Wiley. Yeah, you played with all these people.
I know. I played with Ray Wiley for a long time, until pretty recently, and I produced his last two records.
Okay.
Both of which have garnered lots
that?
Of acclaim.
That's a big.
For him.
Those are big records.
They're big records. Yeah. They were good for me and good for Ray, and a lot of learning. I mean, I learn from every record.
Well, it's interesting because in a situation like that, you're younger than him. And how does he work? Does he put a lot on your plate, or do you guys kind of know what you're doing and you?
We collaborate. I mean, Ray and we played together long enough, and we were in an orbit with his other producer, Kerf Morlix.
Who I love.
Who's great. And another guy you should ask to do your show.
He's been on.
Oh, has he been on?
Yeah, great.
Good stories. So with Ray, you know, Ray's not a technical guy. So if you can create sort of a landscape of sound for him that he's comfortable in, then he can perform. And that's what I would do. And Ray would basically say, you got to make it swampy.
Yeah.
You got to make it greasy. Yeah. And after a while, I figured out what the technical angle was for those particular terms, and I would do that, and then he would be happy, and then he could perform the way that we all love for Ray to perform.
Yeah.
And I think he has a couple of really good records.
Yeah. Who was were you playing on them as well?
I played on them, I usually don't want to engineer and produce and play bass. Definitely not all at the same time.
Yeah, that's a lot. And so then at that point, had you done bands yet outside of Sheboygan?
I've done a number of bands, and I've done two records with the band Heathens. That's the most recent band I've worked with. And I'm working with a band called Shiny Ribs, who are several members of the Gourds.
Okay. Tell me about the band of Heathens. They've really come. Their last record, you did their last record, right?
I did their last
record. That was a big record for them.
Yeah, it was actually bigger than I realized.
Yeah. How, I don't know it.
You know, it's really good. It was kind of a stepping off record for them. They had been identified with a certain kind of sound and a certain kind of approach, and it was time for them to change it up, and they did, and things got a little psychedelic in the studio, and my partner Steve Christensen, who I work with a lot, a Houston engineer producer, real talented guy, we kind of pushed them into some new directions, and as we did on this new record that they made also. And it's good. It's good to see a band grow, and it's good to know that they want to take some chances.
There's multiple songwriters.
Yeah, at that time there were three. Okay. And so it was the unholy trinity.
Right.
And I was always getting caught in between two of them. And it would be a rotating pair who would have either problems or praise for the other one, depending on what day it was. And so I had to really navigate that carefully.
It's like the Eagles almost.
Oh, it's just like the Eagles.
Did you play with Joe Walsh?
I do play with Joe Walsh, speaking of the Eagles. It's great. We're going to go play for 2 or 3 weeks in April and split the bill with Bob Seger. Classic Rock Challenge.
How fun is it to play? I mean, look at you. We're just sitting here talking. You play with Joe Walsh and
stuff. It's crazy. Like, I get on stage and I can't believe it. It's Joe Walsh.
Yeah.
You know every song.
I heard a great fucking interview with him, and I guess he's sobered up.
Yeah, he's been sober for like close to 20 years. But he was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was the all-time reference rock and roll partiers would be Joe Walsh and Keith Moon. In the legends, in the pantheon of rock partying. Doesn't matter what decade it is.
Right.
They kind of wrote the book on it. I mean, Joe drove to a music award show in a tank.
Yeah.
I mean, he used to do stuff like that. He's crazy.
He ran for president.
he had a road case made for a chainsaw that he would take on the road with him, and if he didn't like his room, he decided to make it a suite and he'd saw out the wall. Those are like all true stories.
Who does that stuff? Like, what?
Nobody anymore.
That has never occurred to me to destroy my surroundings. What level of boredom are you at?
I know, you're at a heavy level.
Like, you're playing stadiums. You're in like the biggest band in the world. You get to your room, you just gotta throw the TV out the window.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not gonna have fun unless this is destroyed by me. Is he funny?
Yeah, he's one of the funniest people I've ever played with.
Constantly?
He's constantly like exactly as you would imagine him to be. You know, there's a persona that people might have of him through his music and occasional presence, but he is very funny.
He plays with McCartney a lot.
He started to, because...
Have you crossed paths?
I haven't, but I've done some playing with his brother-in-law.
Wow.
Ringo. That's been fun.
You've been playing with... Oh, yeah.
Only one time, but that was enough for me.
Wow. How was that?
You know, it's amazing. Couldn't believe I was on stage with Ringo.
Wow, was he playing drums or singing?
He's playing drums.
So you were his McCartney at that moment.
That's right. I couldn't turn around and look at him. He was right behind me. I turned around for a minute, and I was so shocked that Ringo was back there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I've got some other friends. Jason Mazursky played with him.
Did he play with Ringo?
Yeah, he plays with Ben Harper, and they were...
Oh, that's right.
They were playing with him. And so how did you get in the Courtyard Hounds?
I got in the Courtyard Hounds.
Were you in the Dixie Chicks? Did you play with them?
Briefly in the Dixie Chicks a couple years ago. And I'm still in the Courtyard Hounds. We just made a really great new record that should be out at some point this year.
Oh, awesome.
And I got to that through the referral of, once again, Charlie Sexton and two of my pals who I played in a band with Jacob Dylan.
Okay. Oh, right. You played with Jacob Dylan as well.
Played with Jacob Dylan.
Oh, God, man.
I can't remember all this stuff, Johnny.
How's he? I met him once. He's really nice and very funny.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
He reminded me a lot of Charlie.
Yeah.
Like, as a guy.
They have a similar temperament. Yeah. You know? And Jacob's funny. I mean, you think about, he literally is Jesus Christ in the musical sense.
Yeah.
He's the Son of God. And he wears it pretty well.
Yeah, he also has like a very like la la, you know, kind of almost like Charlie, like almost like there's this Jim Carrey side that unless you actually get to meet the person, you don't know that it's actually there.
No, he always seems calm and cool.
Yeah, yeah. But he is. There's also like the, you know.
But he's great, man. He made a solo record, Free of the Wallflowers, that I think was a great record, and we toured that for a year.
He just did the Wallflowers just put out a record?
He put the Wallflowers back together, and they made a really good record, and they have an amazing song that was on the radio a few months ago with Mick Jones from The Clash on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Oh, I must be listening to the wrong station.
It was called Reboot the Mission.
I'm going to check that out.
It's good. It's like, it definitely sounds like Jacob. It sounds like the Wallflowers, but because Mick Jones is there, it kind of has a little bit of a well, maybe could have been on London Calling.
Wow.
It's great.
What is, what, like when you're working with these guys, take a guy like Jacob Dylan, how is that, like, is does he have, are you learning the record or is he getting you to do your thing in a situation, like Chris Robinson or Joe Walsh?
It's all, everyone's different, but this is what I think about in that situation. And I just did this. I just went and played with the Tedeschi Trucks band.
Oh, yeah.
Who are amazing musicians. And I was in this headspace once again learning those songs. Where usually, if someone will hire you, because most of these situations I've been hired to come play in a band, as was everyone else. It wasn't like we're all 21 and we're living in the band house.
Right, right.
You know, everybody gets hired and you show up. And I think that the reason that I can do that is I understand that the first rule of business in this situation is you have to know, show up and you have to know the record. You have to know it note for note. You have to have your tone comparable to what's happening there. You want to be able to replicate whatever the artist conceived and made. That's where you start. If you show up and you can do that, you're going to give someone confidence and they're not going to worry. At that point, then you know you can branch out and you can kind of bring your own influence into the picture. But if you show up and you completely throw the baby out with the bathwater and you start over, it's gonna upset people. Yeah. You know, they're gonna be a little confused. So I've always ended up being myself in every gig I've done.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got a good hang, which is an important part of the whole thing.
Thanks, man.
I'm sure you don't throw the vibe in the bus or van.
Try not to. Try and keep my, you know, my socks washed and
keep
the vibe cool.
So, who did the Courtyard Hounds record?
The last two records have been produced by a really talented guy named Jim Scott.
Oh, yeah.
Who's no stranger to a Grammy.
Yeah.
He's one of the most amazing producers I've ever worked with.
Really?
Because he never makes you feel anything other than you're the most perfect person in the world to be there. And no one could do a better job than you. I don't know how he does it.
He just does it. I know, like, when I have been in a situation as a producer, I've called, you know, on the guys that I've felt influenced by that I worked with, like, in the way that they handled themselves with an artist. Do you find yourself doing, like, do you recall certain people when you do that?
I always want to make sure I have the right gist to your question. I always want to work with people that make me feel comfortable and people I respect and people that I look up to.
Right.
I mean, I like to be the caboose in every situation.
Right, but say you're doing, that's a good thing to be.
Yeah, because it makes you work harder.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, when you're working with say you were working on a band of heathens, did you ever at one point think, oh man, what did Jim Scott say right now in this situation?
Yeah, I conjure that up all the time. Yeah. And I'm not afraid to say it because I've worked with people that taught me all sorts of things.
Jim Scott. What did you learn from Jim Scott?
I learned how to make people feel important in the studio.
That is a huge thing.
I went in because Jim was an engineer before he was a producer, and I'm an engineer, so I walked into the first Courtyard Hounds record thinking, I'm going to steal everything I can from this guy. He's a genius. Yeah. And I walked out into the room and looked at how things were being recorded, and it was more or less the same mics in the same places, placed on the same instruments, running through good quality equipment, good quality microphones, good quality equipment. There was no voodoo. He wasn't doing anything special. He had one or two little tricks up his sleeve. That was about it. But I never saw him working. I never saw him sweating and struggling. He was always calm. He was always in charge, and he always had time to talk to people and make sure the song was being played to its utmost. And I thought about him, you know, he was an inspiring guy. I thought that you put the people first, you know. And I'd work with producers where people were anything but first.
Yeah.
You know, I showed up when I was young and to play on a Joe King Carrasco record in New York, and he was working with a famous producer named Richard Goddard, who had done a bunch of big records at the time, and he had filled the front lounge with other musicians because he didn't want the band on the record.
A real big thing that started in the 80s, right?
Yeah, session people.
But just like, you know, you're not going to do this.
Right.
We're going to get the guy.
We're going to get the guy, yeah. And then they'd call the guy, and he'd show up, and he'd play for 3 hours, and then go tee off at 4:15.
Did you ever A, replace anyone, or B, be replaced?
I used to not be willing to replace anyone. I felt like it was bad mojo. But then I came to realize that someone was going to replace them because the decision had been made to replace. And once I came to grips with that, I felt like it wasn't that bad. And if I could make a record better, then I would go in and do it. So I've done that. I've replaced people's parts, and I've been replaced as well. And I used to take it very personally, but now I realize that
it's not you.
It's not me. It's the artist wanted something different.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
I don't know how I ended up. I think being around like Hallman and like great. Michael Ramos and shit when I was just young, like too young to really be able to do anything, that I saw the reality of guys that that put the song, the music, the record, this is all bigger than the individual guy doing sure. anything, because it's the outcome of what you're making. And somehow I always had like a real, I've never been bothered when something's been taken out, or you know what I mean?
That's
I've always been able to handle that sort of criticism because I just want... I don't know how I ended up like that. I remember, though, being young and having bands and looking at the guy and being like, what are you so fucking worried about your little right. drum roll? Like, who cares?
But see, people hang on to that. Yeah. And they can't see the big picture. They see something small. I mean, a record I worked on recently, I struggled with a couple of the guys in the band because they couldn't listen to the song. They could only listen to their part. Yeah. And they were young, and, you know, they'll
That's
learn.
That's just part of youth.
Yeah.
Because you put a lot into that part you were doing.
Right.
And it means a lot to
you. It's
your
identity at that point.
Yeah.
That's all you have.
Yeah.
So you can't let go of it.
Yeah. You're not thinking of it as just a little screw in the big picture of the whole song and record, you know?
No. And like, for instance, on the Courtyard Hounds record, there were a couple of days while we were tracking, there were 9 people playing live in the studio.
Wow.
At that point, you got to let go of a lot.
Yeah.
You got to just do whatever bare bones thing will make the record right.
Yeah. How is it? Is it a good record?
It's a great record. Yeah, I think it's twice the record their last one
are
is.
They're not, so the Dixie Chicks are no more, or they're just on hiatus? Because Natalie's doing her own thing.
Natalie's got a record coming out this summer. They're not done. They're figuring out what else will happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard for them to get together, but you know, you never know. I mean, nobody thought they would get back together and play shows a couple summers ago, and that was really fun.
And you were on that?
I was on that. We played with the Eagles.
Wow. Is that where you met Joe Walsh? Or no, you met Joe Walsh through Ray Wiley?
I met Joe Walsh through Ray Wiley, yeah.
Did you know him when you did the Eagles stuff?
I had met him a couple of times. And then after we did the Eagles stuff, Ray put on a festival. And he asked Joe to come play. And he said, well, if I can play with your band, I'll come play. And then he decided he liked
us. What a flattering fucking thing.
I know. It's crazy.
Joe Walsh wanted to play with you.
I know. When I think about the guys that have played with him, specifically the bass players, they're like idols of mine, you know?
Which Eagles guy are you, Timothy B. Schmidt or what's the other guy? Randy Meisner.
Randy. I don't want to insult anybody, but I'm going to say it's Randy Meisner all the way. Although Timothy B. Schmidt's a good, great singer.
He's great. I like the Randy Meisner era. I also like that they used to leave their shirts unbuttoned. And also they'd wear like football shirts.
Football shirts. That was good look. Good Eagles look. Football shirts and cocaine.
Do you ever hang out with the other guys?
No.
Like Glenn Frey or Don, do you ever exchange words with Don Henley?
Well, the only words I ever exchanged with Don Henley was on the Eagles tour when I walked into catering and he was standing there right in front of me and I went, hey, it's Don Henley. And he turned around and went, howdy, welcome to Thunderdome. Just belly up to the feed trough. And then shook my hand and then moved on.
Well, that's not very exciting.
No,
it's weird though.
It's weird.
It's surreal.
Yeah.
What about, do you like him? You like his drumming and playing and singing? Are you like a Don Henley guy?
I'm going to say that it was really interesting because the Eagles are this big, huge behemoth.
A lot
rock
of people
machine.
Hate them. Like a lot of they're the most hated cool band. People,
in,
you know,
they're the most hated band in popular music, I would think, of the last 40 years. But Don Henley would only play maybe a third of the show, and he would sing or play guitar because they had another drummer, so he could come out to the front of the stage and perform. But when he would get back on the drum kit and play his kind of wacky Don Henley drums and sing while he played, it sounded like the Eagles. It didn't sound like this big kind of production machine like. So, and I don't hate the Eagles because I thought when I was watching those shows, we were in these arenas or stadiums and there's 15,000, 20,000, 40,000 people singing along to every word. Yeah. They're in the cultural fabric. They're more American. They've got the biggest selling record of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, like them or hate them, you can't deny them.
I never my love for them never waned, ever.
Right.
And it was really like when I started Liars and Saints with Joe Hummel, like we wanted to have singers, and like I would always say like, oh, I want this band to be like the Eagles, and then like when Casey joined and Jeremy Nail, they'd be like, stop saying that. It's not like that. That's really a terrible thing to say. And I'm like, well, they're great.
They're great. Every one of those guys sing.
They all sing real well.
Yeah, they're amazing, and they still sing great.
I saw this thing on 60 Minutes when they were doing, maybe it was that tour a couple years ago, where they do this thing called the Circle of Shame before the show, where they just literally sing a cappella in a circle, and like if your shit isn't happening, like it's just right there.
And they know.
Stop singing and go like, hey, get your notes straight.
They know.
You got to be singing this note right here.
You got to.
This is the note you want to be singing. This is the note you're starting on right here.
You got to be singing.
So you got some Courtyard Hound shows coming up.
I think so.
You got some maybe Cotton Mather.
There's a little.
What's going on with that?
Cotton Mather's doing some recording with our friend Darren Murphy.
Yes.
At the drums, who is out currently with the Bodines. Yeah, I'm sure he's excited about that.
I'm sure he is.
So I'm looking forward to recording because I haven't. I do a lot of work with Robert Harrison, the songwriter, and Cotton Mather, but we haven't done much Cotton Mather stuff in a long time, so I'm looking forward to that.
I need to get him in here. Robert's got great stories. He's a nice guy. We've always gotten along.
He's a talkable interview right there, that guy.
Yeah?
He's the sensei.
I like doing this, but the booking style of it, somebody wrote me and was like, I thought you'd never ask me to do this, and I was like, you know how I book this show? Like, I either run into somebody, and I'm like, oh, hey, well, just come. What are you doing, like, Wednesday? Or, like, I'm on Facebook, and someone posts something, hey, my record's coming out, and you're like, oh, hey, this person, you know what I mean?
Well, man, you asked me, and I just left you a voicemail that went, it's about time.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah. No, I mean, I almost didn't make it. I kept canceling on you. But I'm here.
No. That's, you know what? That's another thing, is just kind of the nature. I just kind of always have a bunch coming. I'm doing a lot of them today.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't done any all week.
You're going to load them up at South by Southwest, get some cool people?
I do a lot of stuff I do shorter ones and put together, I put together two shows with, six or seven interviews in them, shorter ones.
Your podcast is growing and getting popular. It's becoming a thing.
Biggest month last month. Thank you.
Really?
Yeah. It is becoming a thing. I'm getting a lot of response from people if I'm late with one, I'll get a, hey, what's going on?
They're paying attention.
Yeah. It's nice. Yeah. I've met people twice. I've been in a circle of people where people are talking and someone will go like, are you the podcast guy? And I'm like, yeah. They're like, I know your voice.
See? People know. And it's
nice
good.
Feeling.
You're telling stories about people that either don't get their stories told, someone like me, for instance.
Yeah.
Or you're getting new stories out of people who are very familiar, like someone like Ian McLaughlin or something like that.
Right. And for me, it's even cooler because that's why you and I have been friends for a long time, and I do like you a lot. I don't get to see you very much. And then there's also stuff that I just don't know about you, and I get to find it out.
And there's probably some stuff you don't want to know about me.
There's a lot of stuff I don't want to know.
Dirty, dark stuff.
So you still, tell me about, we never even talked about the pastry chef stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's my other life that's kind of been put away. That was my B career.
But do you mess around?
Yeah, I mess around, of course. I'll come out of retirement, and very rarely if someone wants a wedding cake.
Yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, Christmas, Thanksgiving, birthdays, I'm always making stuff. But it's funny, you lose your groove the same way if you don't...
If you don't write songs for a long time, it's terrible.
Yeah, and you lose your palate, you lose your timing.
Yeah.
I made a wedding cake for our friends Bucca and Sally Allen a few years ago, and I don't think I'd baked anything in 3 years, and I started and I threw it away and started again because I didn't have it together. It's like, wait a minute, I did this for years.
Yeah.
I had to pull it together.
When you did it for years, were you like in a kitchen where you live in that whole kitchen thing? Because that's a whole culture in itself.
It's a culture and it's just as rock and roll as music is. It's just as decadent
and weird.
Almost more
the Kitchen Confidential.
Oh, that's book. The truth, that book.
Yeah.
That tells it like it is.
Yeah.
No, I always wanted to be a restaurant pastry chef, never a hotel pastry chef.
Okay.
Because restaurants, it's a smaller venue that you perform in, and you do perform, and the food is different every day.
Yeah.
And you can change your menu. And I loved it. I loved having to think on my feet.
Yeah.
You know, it was exciting.
It is exciting.
I would have a lot of people after I started off, I was pretty awful, and then I got better, and then I finally got good. Not unlike playing music.
Right.
But I would get people that would want to come and intern, or they'd want a job, and they'd be fresh out of culinary school. And I often tell people this story because I think it has something you should think about it when you're thinking about cooking. And they would give me their resume of what they'd done, and they would seem to be very together. And I would go, all right, well, then let me bring you into my world. And I would take them through the corridors of Jeffrey's restaurant, which is
right.
where I would work here in Austin for
a
lot of years.
Fancy place.
Fancy schmancy. Yeah. Recently just closed this year.
Sad.
And I would take them back to the walk-in, and I would say, it's 8:30 in the morning on Saturday. You have a raging hangover. You haven't had enough sleep. There's 180 people on the books. Out of your 6 desserts, you've got 15 portions of 2 left. The other 4 are decimated. You have 90 seconds to come up with 6 desserts. And I'd open the walk-in door and I'd say, everything's in there. Go. And if they would go, well, there's oranges and there's Madagascar vanilla and there's some cream and eggs and I can make brulee. Okay. And they would start reeling stuff off, or they would look at me and they would kind of stammer and go, but I need some recipes.
No job for you.
No job for you, son.
Yeah. Wow, that's intense. That was exciting just now when you told me that. I was trying to think of what I would make. I'm going to go look at my fridge.
That's it, man. That's what I would do on Saturday mornings. I'd be out playing all night, and I'd have to come in and get it together, and it would always be disaster, and there'd be no preparation. And restaurants are held together by a thread. The nicer they are, usually, the finer the thread, which is kind of funny.
Do you find, George, that almost everything is held together by a thread, really?
Pretty much. Right now,
I feel like our government is like held by a thread. The whole like economy of the world is just held together by a very thin thread. Yeah.
Don't let it fall.
Yeah. Making records sometimes.
All right, so what about you? I mean, you're deeply involved
about me?
Here, I'm switching the tables here. You're deeply involved in Skyrocket, a very successful band, but what about Johnny Gowdy? Are you going to ever make your own record again?
Yeah.
I'm curious because I'm a fan.
This whole setup.
It's great.
I know you are a fan. You've always been incredibly encouraging.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I appreciate that, and I'm a big fan of yours. I am going to do stuff. I'm starting to play some solo shows. I'm playing tomorrow night with Tony Scalzo.
Oh, that's great.
And I've had a big paradigm shift. I became single this year. The podcast has been a big thing, and I've really been trying to... I've been trying to not push it harder than it needs to grow normally, because I don't want to... I want it to be a very natural thing.
It'll find its way in the world.
It actually takes a little time to keep it together. The research, you know, I was up until 3 a.m. watching things about Bill Carter last night.
Is he coming on?
He's coming in today.
That's
and then
great.
This girl, Emmy Robin, this actor girl, I watched her movie last night too.
That's great.
Yeah, she shows her boobs in the movie.
Ooh, nice.
I don't know how to bring that up. I've never interviewed someone whose boobs I've seen.
Well, can't you just stare at them for the whole interview and say, I couldn't help but stare.
I'm trying to find a way to talk about it without sounding creepy. Because now that I'm 44 years old, you're talking to a girl like, you know, even she's in her 20s. You're like, it's all your boobs. It's all your boobs. And, you know, she's there. So it's like, it's me between her and the door. It ends up like that Christopher Walken Continental. Like, have some champagne.
Yeah. I think she'd probably, if she showed her boobs in the movie, she's probably no stranger to the question.
Yeah. I do have an angle. Like, what, you know, how is that with, you know, there's a Jason Segel story with the Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I heard him on Fresh Air. And he said that the opening scene where he's naked, you know that movie?
Right.
And he's shaking his wiener and just totally naked. He was sitting next to his mom at the premiere who didn't even know that was going to happen. And she was like, literally, don't ever. Like, please tell me that that's. He didn't tell her anything. And then he came out naked and was shaking his wiener.
His poor mom.
I know. Can you imagine?
She probably hadn't seen that wiener
since he was a year.
What about your
dad?
A year.
You know, if you're a girl and you're... I mean, it was like a makeout scene. She's taking the dude's belt off and stuff. I'm
right.
Like, whoa, hey.
Kind of getting freaky here.
All I could think was like, you know, what about your little brother, your grandma? I was like, what?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Your grandma's having a heart attack in the back of the theater.
Right. My grandma can handle a lot of stuff. She's actually been on the show.
Your grandma's been on the show?
Sometimes I have her review a movie.
That's pretty so funny. Fantastic.
She reviewed The Help last year, and she said, I like it because it's very funny, and also it's serious. So perfect. There you go. That's a good review for a movie.
That's good. You should maybe think about getting her to co-interview. It could sort of be like the Ed McMahon, Andy, and Conan kind of thing, and she could be your foil on some of these interviews. It would be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we taught a cooking class at Central Market.
You and your grandmother?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I have it on videotape. I gave DVDs to everyone in my family this year for Christmas.
Man, that's fantastic. That Central Market, like lots of people we know have taught musicians, like Michael Fricasso and I taught some classes, and he still does.
Yeah. Trish.
Trish did it.
A lot.
Yeah, it's good.
You guys are, Michael's a big cooking guy. Trish is a big cooking lady.
Yeah.
You're obviously culinary expert.
Culinary.
I'm trying to get into it because I don't eat right, and I'm trying to get into a thing
where
I cook.
You're too skinny, Johnny.
No, I'm not. I'm starting to get a little blah, blah, blah. You know that thing where you're brushing your teeth and your opposite, like your tits jiggling like an actual boob?
Yeah, I know that all too well.
I don't know why I just said that on the podcast. This is going to keep me from getting ladies. So what, you just finished doing the Heathens album?
Finished doing that.
Like yesterday or something?
Oh, maybe 3-4 weeks ago. Oh,
okay.
And so that's going to get mastered here shortly, and that's going to get released. And I'm hoping it'll be a good record for them. It's once again a very different record. You know, hopefully their fans will like it. Yeah. I'm not sure who their fans are, but I know that...
They have a lot of fans.
They have a lot of fans all over the world, and I think it's important to think about people's fans when you're going to make a record for them. You want the artist to remain creative always, but you don't want to alienate everyone.
Right.
You know, I've played with people who I've watched them alienate their fans, just choosing to. In fact, we both played with some of them.
Yeah. Ian, he talked about it on here.
Ian's finally remembering that he had this other career before.
But he's playing with that band now.
Yeah. And for a long time, it was like he was St. Peter in the whole thing constantly. It's like, I know I did not do that. I was not a blues guitar player.
You know, he's so amazing. And I went with them on the journey. It was interesting as his friend, though, to go like, man, you're really making people mad.
Yeah, all the time. Man, the first tour I did with him, I remember like gig three.
Say it. It makes me laugh so hard when you say it, dude.
We went to Louisiana and played, and all I heard from the crowd was, why'd you cut your hair, man?
When you told me that, story when we first started, when we were playing together with them. And when we went to Lubbock, someone said it. Remember that? Someone yelled it out in the audience. That fucking killed me, man. Ian was going to blame us for like bringing that, you know, bringing the into everyone's subconscious because we were just thinking it so hard the whole time.
It's just so funny because like that stuff happens. Like the more that you want to not admit that you had this other side, the more it comes out to haunt you, you know?
You know, and it's funny because you can alienate people. Like I can look back on it now, but I can look back and see what happened to a band like Mr. Rocket Baby. After like a year and a half or so of like the funny whatever, I was like, hey, let's just be normal now.
Right.
No tights, just dudes, jeans, t-shirts. Let's just do this thing like this now. Half the crowd, like immediately.
There's no more vaudeville,
like,
man.
What happened to the guys? These aren't the same guys.
There's no more entertainment.
Right.
Yeah, fans get angry. They get pissed off. They want what they want.
You know, that happens to me too sometimes. Like I have that problem with Radiohead. I want to like them as much as I used to now, but I'm kind of like, what?
Our pal Lars Goransson, who you should also have on this show.
I've been trying to.
Really interesting interview. He's just so busy. It's like he just says, well, you know, they make boring records now. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't want to care. I used to care. Now I don't care.
Nobody cares.
Meaningless to me. Meaningless.
It seems almost like people are just saying they like them because it's cool to say it.
Actually, you know what? I really still love them. And I saw them for the first time last year after all these years of always missing my opportunity.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most creative and amazing shows that I've seen in a decade. And I'll defend them.
Yeah.
I will.
Oh, you know, man, I mean, I've seen them twice. I saw once was really a terrible show where the singer guy made everybody in the audience uncomfortable because he was having a bad day.
That's bad.
It was really uncool. And then I saw them and it was uplifting. It was after they, you know, the early 2000s when they were doing...
The big shift. The early days of the big shift.
Yeah, the sequence things. Yeah.
But they still play guitars.
Yeah.
They still turn them up.
The Rock plays pianos and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What else am I missing? Am I missing anything?
I don't know.
I wonder if Walter Cronkite ever did that in the middle of an interview, just looked at the ground and went,
what else?
Am I missing anything?
Yeah. Is there anything significant? We didn't talk about the sex change, whatever. Yeah, he probably wouldn't do that.
No.
It's all right. It's
new
honest.
Style.
Man, you know.
Narrow casting, not broadcasting. That's what this is called, because it's specific to a specific group of people.
Yeah.
I heard Kevin Smith use that.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I like that.
He's abandoned making movies to just do podcasts.
Really?
He literally has a podcast network and he puts out a daily podcast and then he puts out about 5 or 6 other podcasts a week.
It's amazing.
He has a podcast just about Batman.
That's a
narrow
audience.
But he has all kinds of people on there. Like he has like, you know, Mark Hamill and they just talk about Batman for 3 hours.
Wow. I could talk about Batman for 3 hours.
Me too.
I wouldn't get bored.
Who's your favorite superhero? And we'll end on that note.
I'd have to say it would be Captain America.
Yeah.
Odd call, I know.
That is an odd call.
But he had the best suit when I was a kid. Still love him.
Good suit.
Yeah.
I'm a Batman guy.
I'm a huge Batman guy. He's number two.
He's a guy.
And he's number two by that thread.
Slim.
That things
the thread that holds the whole world together.
Man, I really appreciate you getting me to come do this.
Yeah,
it's
man. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
And it'll be out soon. Everyone, look up George Roof if you're a band. You might want him to produce your record.
You might.
If you're a guy that has some cash.
Or if you're a girl that has some cash.
Right. By guys, I mean everyone.
Right.
One sec.
Hey, guys.
Hey, everyone, it's me. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, man.
All right. Oh, yeah. George Roof. Love that guy. Man, he is cool. I'm going to start a series called the Master Series where I get these masterful cats to come in and talk about. He's like a Zen. Guy didn't even yell at me once. Known him for a long time. Love him a lot, George Roof. I'd like to thank him for coming by. I'd like to thank you for listening. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, recommend this to your friends. Subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. Go out, check out something that George Roof does. He's great, you know. Let's band together as an audience for each other. And then also hug at the end of it all. I don't know what kind of hippie message I'm pushing here. I'm really not a hippie. So I guess thank you for listening. Let's get back to a little music co-produced by George Roof and Ray Wiley Hubbard with George playing the bass. This is another song from Ray Wiley Hubbard. Let's get down.
When I was a young man about 21 years old, y'all, all I wanted was a stripper girlfriend and a gold-top Les Paul. Be careful of the things you wish for. You might get them. There was a nightclub in Dallas. It's called Mother Blues. It's where Lightning Hopkins played and Freddie King even paid some dues. And all the dealers and gamblers and young white hipsters, they all made the scene. The girl at the door who checked IDs was just 16. It was not a place for law-abiding citizens. Jackie Jones, he had him a habit. He just couldn't stop. He said, give me $500 and I say I'm a Les Paul gold top. I drove my daddy's car down to Ross Avenue and I sold it. I guess I should have told him. He alluded to the police that someone stole it. It was just the first of many bad decisions I was to make for the next 20 years. Oh, but I had me a guitar. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that the real nightlife begins after the clubs close, what they call after hours. It's 2 a.m. and everybody's gone but the band, the dealers, and Jack Jones. And then the girls from the Landing Strip Club come over after they put their clothes back on. So I'm at my blues and I'm sitting on an amp. I'm playing Twist and Shout. And this tall drink of water walk in looked like she might have to shoot her way out. She come up to me. She says, you know anything good on that guitar? I didn't say nothing. I just kept on playing. She said, have you ever heard this song called Pope Sally Danny? I just kept on playing. She said, every time I hear that song, my insides feel like warm butter. And I just want to take off my clothes and dance around in my underwear. I said, down in Louisiana, oh, where the alligator grows so mean. Whoa, oh, that's all I knew of it, but it was enough. Oh. So we hit it off, me and this dancer. We hit it off like a metaphor for a hydrogen bomb. We was a rich uranium supercritical mass. We was a chain reaction. It was love and lust, mostly lust, but a mutual attraction. So there I was, boys, at 21 years old. I had it all. I had a fine stripper girlfriend and a gold top Les Paul. Oh, the future. Oh, it looked promising. Oh, but there were dark clouds on the horizon. She was a beautiful girl, but she liked to drink tequila. And whoa, that ain't all. I come home 4 or 5 times and shit on my Les Paul. We broke up and she went to Hollywood. She married an actor. She got a job dancing on the Hudson Brothers TV show with Modern Lipstick from Max Factor. Oh, I got over. I'm glad she done all right. I'm glad she done all right. Oh, yes, I am. Well, now me, I never busted through the gates into the big time as a rock and roll star. For 40 years, I just carried around an old gold top guitar. But love and fate are mysterious things in this funky old world. It was 20 years ago, I ended up marrying that Mother Blues door girl. We had us a boy, he's 18 years old now. He's playing guitar. He ended up with that Les Paul gold top, yes it did. Now I don't know if he's gonna hang his life on it or not, but I'm very grateful for the time I get to share the stage with him. I'm grateful for the time I get to play with musicians like George Reeve and Rick Richards. And I'm grateful I get to write these old songs and travel around the world and play them for people and they come out and hear me play. And the days that I keep my gratitude higher than my expectations, well, I have really good days.